Accession number 24193, reel 15.
Mr. Tal, reel 15. We're talking about when you'd pull back into sort of partial reserve positions in the Hill 238 area, Cohen Sound area. Mm-hmm. And you said, you, what happened next, basically, is where we're up to?
Well, we, one particular feature I remembered, the gaps we eventually began to realise we were being looked at and observed. So the gaps in where there was direct visual contact with the enemy were then covered by huge, great camouflage netting put up by the engineers on supports and so on. And this, you know, one felt a lot of comfort and security. But I think the Chinese had their weapons on fixed lines, although we had a sort of comfort blanket of the big camouflage nets, we always seemed still to be shot at. And you would not walk, you ran past, or you, if you were in a vehicle, and the only vehicles then were jeeps and trailers that far forward. If you were using a jeep and trailer for ammunition or whatever, you would go fast, other than when it was very dusty. And that time of year, I remember there was a lot of dust about. You didn't want to create the dust and attract attention because of that feature. But these nets were everywhere. And on the supply routes back from the reserve position to and around battalion headquarters and so on, and the roads, tracks would zigzag up the mountains, great areas on the forward side would be blanketed by these big, huge camouflage nets. Another feature that I'd forgotten about at this time were what was called a cab rank, which is an aircraft support over the battlefield. And a cab rank was 3 to 4 aircraft of a Sabre jet type, which was amongst the first jet fighter bombers. And they would, on request, and called a cab rank because on request, if there was an activity planned, they would fly overhead for half an hour, and you could call them down on specific grid references, map references, and so on. Or occasionally they would come over to just fly over no man's land and the reverse slopes of the enemy. And it was very interesting to watch them in action, dive bombing, and you would hear the enemy's defensive fire, which was often heavy machine gun, but no fired from round weapon pits. And they dropped their bombs, and maybe 4, 6 bombs each, and in a steep dive, and then pull out, a lot of noise, some machine gunning from the aircraft. But what was particularly frightening was on one event, for some reason, one was shot down in front of us. And that was very, very disturbing. And there was no visual anti-aircraft fire around. Normally, you know, you'd see black puffs in the sky. Well, this was a steep dive, leveling out 100 feet or so above the enemy positions. Be a lot of enemy machine gun fire, and maybe slightly heavier weapons. And one actually just didn't ever pull out. And that was quite sobering. They would come from either HMS Ocean, which was offshore, or from, more likely, from the American fleet. But that was another weaponry that we had in support, but not that common. I think we then moved on to still in pursuit of a prisoner. Who were we dealing with? One felt our intelligence, as it was in the beginning of the Korean War, was very poor, had only marginally improved, and we really didn't know who we were fighting, which regiment, which enemy units, other than the People's Volunteer Army. So one day in May, there was an arrangement for a very serious fighting patrol to capture an enemy on the hill leading up to 317, which, as we said recently, had just been acquired by the Chinese by knocking the KOSBs off the hill 317, and where Speakman won his VC. That the intent was a fighting patrol, a big one, a very big one, I think our biggest, with three units, and I don't know how the composition was arrived at. I don't know in which order the selection of the units was used or how it was arrived at, but the patrol was a fighting patrol with Lieutenant Wormold, Jonathan Wormold, who was commander of the Pioneer Platoon, which was a very interesting unit. They did all the mine laying, some of the skilled demolition work, use of explosive for blowing up rocks if they were in the way of digging trenches and bunkers and so on, and had built bridges if necessary, or anything that was above a platoon or company's capability in the building or destruction world. And they always felt a bit left out. The pioneer sergeant was the only gentleman in the regiment to be allowed to grow a beard. I remember that. And that came out of long history. So they were chosen, Jonathan Wormold, and I would think about 12 men were chosen to actually rush the first one or two Chinese trenches on the forward slope of Hill 317. 317 was a sharp peak of a hill with prominent shoulders and with features running towards our own lines and ending up in the valley. So there was always a climb. And the second part of the patrol was what was called Base 2, which was to be a few hundred yards behind Jonathan Wormold's patrol. Call that Section 1 or Phase 1. Behind it, where I was present, was a support unit, quite heavily armed, of about, I'm going to say, about 20 people, soldiers, with my wireless operator, Ginger Nutter, N-U-T-T-E-R, who actually received a mention in dispatches for his service on that patrol. And he unusually, for a patrol, was carrying a 31 set, which was the biggest radio within, biggest radio network within the battalion. And he was on to battalion headquarters, the battle adjutant's office, as well as the company commander, as well as all the supporting troops, including not only the 3-inch mortars, I think the artillery, 25 pounders, and also unusually the Centurion tanks that were very much in defence. So I commanded these three sections. We talked with Section 1, Jonathan Wormold, Section 2, which is where I was present, as a secure base for the final advance to the Chinese lines. And that was 200 yards-ish from where Wormold got up and charged the lines.
Now, there was another,
the soldier.
According to the thing, there's another firm base. Yes. Firm Base 1 under Henson.
Right. I may have the numbers the wrong way around.
No. You were firm base 2, yeah.
I was firm base 2. I said Wormold was 1. He might have been 3. So coming on backwards from the enemy, then Wormold in front, myself with base 2, and I would call it base 3 or maybe base 1, was Tom Henson. And Tom Henson was the collecting firm base in the valley onto which we were to gather with our prisoners, with whatever happened during the event. I was in command of all three bases, and our mission was to capture a prisoner. We set out, I think it was, I think the 23rd of May, but I can't recall precisely.
29th of May. Well, only according to the history. I mean,
right, okay. Well, it was certainly in the latter half of May. We set out in the evening. I remember for the first time I'd used an ability to see at night, which was a radioscope, which was fitted to a weapon. I think it was an American carbine, because it was an American equipment. And it gave you a visibility of about 50 yards. Not very clear. It was like looking through a fish tank with some algae in it. And it was very useful, because as we started out, Wormel's group and my base group too set off together, and we were to meet up with Henson's team as the, let's call that the firm base, Henson, and mine was base two, and Wormold was base one. It was very useful because we set off, base one and two, towards the enemy, in generally single file, moving cautiously. Wormold was behind me. I was leading the advance at that time. And we were to meet up with Henson's base, and we stopped. I remember this so clearly. And there was considerable movement to our front, and we were a quarter of the way up the feature. And on my right was this significant noise of people moving. And I used the scope to see through the dark, and I remember so clearly. Probably about 25 yards away, I saw Henson's face, which it happened to be at that time a very sort of oval face, and I recognized him, and he was leading, and I was so relieved. Anyway, we met up. He established his base there. We then went on, so everybody knew where his base was. I wanted to make particular attention that all the soldiers knew where that base was.
Now, what sort of terrain? You've mentioned the terrain, but what sort of fauna? Flora?
Right. It would have been low scrub when it wasn't bomb damaged. The floor of the valley was tracks. Wherever you could, there'd be a rice field. So there were tracks, paths, rice fields in the valley. And then when you started going up a feature, immediately you had light scrub, swamp-type trees. When I say swamp, not because of wet, but because of they were just scruffy, nondescript trees, a lot of granite. And the paths were particularly noisy up the slopes of the features because they had stones and small bits of granite and so on them, and they weaved around a lot. And you generally, in this area, had to stay on the path because to move through the scrub would have been too noisy. Now, there was a lot of bomb damage, a lot of scrub was down. The area had been fought over. There were bits of battle left around. So Henson's feature, Henson's base, was it really established just off the valley and up the feature, but not very far. But we all knew where he was, and we could identify. I think there was a pile of rocks quite close. So everybody knew that. It was by then completely dark. The moon was coming up a bit later. We then went on, leading the way up the feature, quite quiet. Quite still. We obviously moved as silently as we could. And finally we came to a position which had been previously agreed upon, where we were 200 or 300 yards short of the enemy's first line. There was no enemy firing, no presence. We'd called down no supporting fire. No movement or no noise at all. We got base two spread out in a defensive position on this feature. Again, very, very sensitive to the fact that the enemy trenches were above us, but no movement, no noise from that at all. Jonathan came up with his 12 people, and we lay down, I remember, side by side, and he was to go in at, oh, just before midnight.
Now, can you give us a sort of character or picture of what he was like, Jonathan Wormwell?
Yes, he was a wonderful person. He was, like me, young. He had a ginger moustache. He was very Norfolk. He came from Norfolk. He had Norfolk in his blood. A serious young man, very careful about his troops, loved birds, bees, loved animals, wildlife, and a delightful, delightful person. We were all very fond of him in the regiment, and it was a wonderful, in some way he touched all our lives, because he'd come and do, with his pioneer platoon, come and do jobs for us. And they were always scruffy, dangerous jobs, for which, you know, there was no glamour. But he did it with great enthusiasm, and I think a very brave person, nice person.
Now, that was just so. What happened next then?
Right, we settled base two down. I had my wireless operator with me and troops on either side in a sort of line, but a defensive curve about it, almost like a bow of a bow and arrow, facing towards the enemy. And Jonathan came up with his troops, and we all lay down and had a bit of a rest. We were ahead of our time, and Jonathan and I lay down together, looked up the path and towards the enemy, and you could see the skyline, not the absolute skyline, but you could see the rise where these trenches were, and the trenches went from, you know, left to right, as well as on up to 12 o'clock. And up and obviously towards the peak of 317. But we were still fairly down the forward slope of 317, but quite clearly where the enemy were in possession. Jonathan and I talked, made sure we knew what we were all doing. We had our rest, and then about 5 minutes before the time he was to attack, and I can't remember precisely, but let's say it was 11:45 p.m., something like that, not like 0001. He gathered his men and went quietly up. We shook hands, said good luck, we're here. You can call us verbally, if you will, we'll be here. And if you get into trouble, we'll come and get you, or you fall back on us. Or if you really are gaining, call us forward, and we will help you. So he went up maybe 50 yards, 100 yards. It was getting a bit lighter, I think, then. And he spread his men out in a sort of line abreast. And then he walked on up, and it was all quite quiet, quite quiet. And suddenly all hell broke loose. More from the enemy at first than from us. There were grenades, there was shooting of both burp guns and less automatic weapons. I heard some of our 303 rifles, you could tell the difference. And I thought I heard a Bren gun, but I'm not sure. I don't think they had a Bren gun. And it may be one of our Bren guns firing. The trick was not to shoot our own troops. And so our orders were not to fire unless I had given the order, or unless, you know, and the spread of the troops was probably 30 yards on either side, so it was a span of about 60 yards, and they were only to fire if they were actually in to defend themselves. There was a tremendous amount of shooting, almost as though the enemy knew we were coming, and almost as though it was an ambush. I had And we had, with Jonathan, previously arranged that if there was no, if it was going to be a sustained battle, and it sounded as though it was going to be a sustained battle, we were worried about reinforcements joining the enemy, coming up from different sides, and maybe from defensive positions we didn't know where they were. So I started calling down artillery fire on the top and the shoulders of the feature of 317. The firing still went on, and still no sign or sound from the base one that had attacked the Chinese lines. And in fact, the firing was more from the Chinese rather than from our side. And no signal, no communication whatsoever. We then felt movement on our left and started receiving small arms fire in our general direction. I don't think particularly well aimed. And then started receiving mortar fire from our left. Generally speaking, small mortar fire, not the 80 millimeter, but something smaller, almost similar to our 3-inch mortars, 60 millimeter, I think they were called, which impressed us that we must be close, because that has not a very great range. And we suddenly were on our left being mortared quite consistently in the area, but not accurately, but all around us. Still no activity, from no call, no communication with Wormhold at all. The firing then stopped for a few minutes, then started again with great intensity. Maybe it was 5 minutes, maybe it was 10 minutes. All the time, the 25-pounders were providing the support onto Hill 317. The enemy must have thought there was probably a major attack coming. Our own 3-inch mortars had a defensive fire task, and Bill Deller would know about that. The machine guns also I called in to fire over our heads and Wormhold's head. Still no news. And I wondered really what to do. We radioed back. Chinjanata kept me up to date with what others were saying on the radio net. I'd asked if there'd been any report, and Henson was on the radio as well. There was no indication from anybody about anything as to what was happening, other than the defensive fire tasks were going on. And I wondered what on earth had happened. Clearly things were not going well. So, and at that time, a group of Chinese, and they were clearly Chinese because we heard them talking, appeared on our left, and we fired at them. I fired at them with my, they were that close. And I don't know if we hit any, but there was a lot of Chinese talking, and we threw hand grenades, and we fired. And that didn't seem to come anymore. I think they went away. At this stage, still no activity, no communication from the front. So I reported this back, and I said I thought the only thing we could do was to go forward quietly and see what was happening. So I said we would do this. I think the battle adjutant probably agreed. So we went forward. I remember Ginger Nata, who was a character, and I said, well, come on, we're going to go forward. He said, sir, do you really mean we're going to go? And I said, well, yes, why? He said, well, I was praying that you wouldn't take us forward. And we had a little giggle about that in this rather tense situation.
Now, so how many were to go forward?
I took about 12, half the group. We reorganized the group, put them... I withdrew the left-hand group that had had a lot of all the activities so far, put them across the path, and I took the right-hand group with me. About 6 to 8, and we spread out, but in 5 yards apart, and went cautiously up. The enemy were shooting and firing all the time, but you couldn't see them because they were in the trenches. But then we came across our wounded, and people, you know, dazed and stumbling around. So we collected up what we found, sent them back. I would send somebody who was with me back with, say, two of them. They would go to the firm base, our half of the firm base, with instructions to take them down, the either the wounded or those that were dazed, take them down to Henderson's firm base. And I think we did that about three times. And then clearly there was nothing in front of me except a very hostile and a very angry series of trenches, all of which were firing. And then the mortars on the left-hand side from the Chinese side came again and started firing along the general ridge where we were. I then called the tank, the 25-pounders, on Hill 355, who had a pre-assigned defensive fire tower, or an aggressive fire task, to fire on areas of around Hill 317. And I called those down. So there was a major sort of sound of a major battle going on, whilst we lay there, looking, waiting, hoping to find or come across wounded. We searched the ground. We were on our hands and knees by then. But I had given orders that we would not fire. I didn't want our presence there to be known. And I felt the enemy were all firing over our heads, which one often does if one's shooting at night. And there was absolutely no sign of anybody after we'd sent two groups, maybe three groups back. By then I had two with me and the radio operator, I think. And clearly nothing was happening except these lines were firing, heavier machine gun firing. I don't think they knew exactly where we were, but we weren't hit. So after a while, and the pyrotechnics were going on, the tanks were firing, and this beautiful, beautiful greenish, red, yellow, gentle arc of a firework without any sound would travel over our heads or slightly to our left, where most of the fire was coming from, and would fire away, doing excellent work. I know no reinforcements could come. I then had the decision, well, do we get up and charge the same line of trenches and rationalise to what purpose? Clearly we would not survive. We wouldn't do our job, which was to recuperate any damage or act in support of the fire of the fighting patrol of Jonathan Wormald. So after a while, and the firing of both sides was going on, I decided we would withdraw and got back to our own firm base, by which there was only half there, because those that were there had gone on to Henderson's firm position. And I can't remember how many we rescued. Let's say half a dozen. The rest had gone. The rest seemed there was absolutely nothing there. It was darkish. You could make out the areas of the hills, the skyline. By then, I would think it was about 3 a.m, and there seemed no purpose. The enemy fire was closing in. I remember we were getting bombs very close to us. I think we had a couple of wounded, but nothing serious. There were bullets beginning to whistle about our ears. And again, we had a Bren gun, and I told the Bren gun to spray fire again to our left.